And welcome to the reading of the Dubuque Telegraph Herald for Tuesday, February 23rd, 2021. I'm your reader, Paula Carezzi. On the front page of today's paper is an Associated Press story written by Heather Hollingsworth and Tammy Weber titled COVID-19 Deaths in U.S. Surpass 500,000. The number accounts for 20% of the nearly 2.5 million coronavirus deaths globally. The COVID-19 death toll in the U.S. topped 500,000 Monday, a staggering number that all but matches the number of Americans killed in World War II, Korea, and Vietnam combined. President Joe Biden held a sunset moment of silence and a candle lighting ceremony at the White House and ordered American flags lowered at federal buildings for 5 days. Quote, "We have to resist becoming numb to the sorrow," Biden said. "We have to resist viewing each life as a statistic or a blur," end quote. A president whose own life has been marked by family tragedy, Biden spoke in deeply personal terms, referencing his own losses as he tried to comfort the huge number of Americans whose lives have been forever changed by the pandemic. Quote, "I know all too well. I know what it's like to not be there when it happens," said Biden, who has long addressed grief more powerfully than perhaps any other American public figure. Quote, "I know what it's like when you are there holding their hands as they look in your eye and they slip away. That black hole in your chest, you feel like you're being sucked into it," end quote. The half-million milestone, as recorded by Johns Hopkins University, comes as states redouble efforts to get the coronavirus vaccine into arms after last week's winter weather closed clinics, slowed vaccine deliveries, and forced tens of thousands of people to miss their shots. Despite the rollout of vaccines since mid-December, a closely watched model from the University of Washington projects more than 589,000 dead by June 1st. The U.S. toll is by far the highest reported in the world, accounting for nearly 20% of the nearly 2.5 million coronavirus deaths globally, though the true numbers are thought to be significantly greater, in part because many cases were overlooked, especially early in the outbreak. The first known deaths from the virus in the U.S. were in early February 2020. It took 4 months to reach the first 100,000 deaths. The toll hit 200,000 in September and 300,000 in December, then took just over a month to go from 300,000 to 400,000, and another month to climb from 400,000 to 500,000. The U.S. recorded an estimated 405,000 deaths in World War II, 58,000 in the Vietnam War, and 36,000 in the Korean War. Average daily deaths and cases have plummeted in the past few weeks. Virus deaths have fallen more than 4,000 reported on some days in January to an average of fewer than 1,900 per day. But experts warn that dangerous variants could cause the trend to reverse itself, and some experts say not enough Americans have been inoculated yet for the vaccine to be making much of a difference. Instead, the drop-off in deaths and cases has been attributed to the passing of the holidays, the cold and bleak days of midwinter when many people stay home, and better adherence to mask rules and social distancing. Dr. Ryan Stanton, an emergency room physician in Lexington, Kentucky, who has treated scores of COVID-19 patients, said he never thought the U.S. deaths would be so high. Quote, "I was one of those early ones that thought this may be something that may hit us for a couple of months. I definitely thought we would be done with it before we got into the fall, and I definitely didn't see it heading off into 2021, Stanton said. Christy Sork, an intensive care nurse at Hutchinson Regional Medical Center in Hutchinson, Kansas, said she is encouraged by the declining caseload and progress in vaccinating people, but, quote, "I know we are so far from over," end quote. People, quote, "are still dying and families are still isolated from their loved ones who are unable to be with them, so that it is still pretty heart-wrenching," she said. Snow, ice, and weather-related power outages closed some vaccination sites and held up shipments across a large swath of the nation, including in the Deep South. As a result, the 7-day rolling average of administered first doses fell by 20% between February 14th and February 21st, according to data from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. The White House said that about a third of the roughly 6 million vaccine doses delayed by bad weather were delivered over the weekend, with the rest be expected to be delivered by midweek, several days earlier than originally expected. White House Coronavirus Response Coordinator Andy Slavitt on Monday attributed the improved timeline to a, quote, all-out, round-the-clock, end quote, effort over the weekend that included employees at one vaccine distributor working night shifts to pack vaccines. Also on the front page of today's Telegraph Herald is a story by Bennett Goldstein titled, Colleges Seek Applicant Rebound. Some area universities record declines in applications from international students, while others open up their recruitment. Victor De Lima Tosi moved to Dubuque last spring to play soccer at Clark University. A college transfer, the 21-year-old junior from Franca, Brazil, is one of the many international students the institution has recruited through its athletic program. Quote, the beginning was very hard, difficult because of the language, Tosi said. Nowadays, it is way better, end quote. More than 30 coaches have gone to great lengths to market the university's athletic programs to community colleges and foster connections in high schools abroad. Clark has observed a consequent increase in applications. From the fall of 2020 through January 31st, the university received 165 international submissions, up from 120 in 2019 and 20. Quote, I think this COVID-19 pandemic, the silver lining, is that it had all of us scratching our heads in leadership about what we can be doing so that we don't feel the repercussions of the pandemic when it comes to our enrollment numbers, said Ali Boyd, Director of Enrollment. Quote, let's provide greater customer service. Let's have that personalized approach. That's just what we've done, end quote. Colleges across the country have observed similar trends, particularly larger and more selective institutions. The number of international applicants applying using the Common Application Form, a widely used college admission form, increased 9% during the 2020-2021 college application cycle compared to the year prior. Countries demonstrating significant growth in applicants included Brazil, Canada, India, Pakistan, and the United Kingdom. Such a trend comes as welcome news to universities, where admissions officers hope to see enrollment increase as COVID-19 vaccinations accelerate, borders reopen, and a new U.S. presidential administration eases travel and visa restrictions imposed by now former President Donald Trump. Quote, once the pandemic has pushed through a little bit, our goal is to certainly increase the number of international students attending, said Kari Hill, Executive Director of Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion at the University of Wisconsin-Platteville. Enrollment of international students within the U.S. began to decline in the 2016-2017 academic year, reversing a decades-long trend of steady growth, according to a report from the Institute of International Education and U.S. Department of State. Enrollment dipped from 903,000 students that year to 852,000 in 2019-20 and declined an additional 16% in the fall of 2020. In the Tri-State region, shrinking student bodies at most colleges predated the pandemic. From the fall of 2015 to the fall of 2020, enrollment was down by 20.5% at Clark, 19.8% at the University of Wisconsin-Platteville, and 8.1% at Loras College. Only the University of Dubuque had a positive five-year trend, with a 1.4% increase. However, enrollment at the University of Dubuque in the fall was down 2.5% compared to one year prior. International students who often pay higher tuition rates represent a vital source of revenue for colleges, especially those that saw revenue declines during the COVID-19 pandemic. UWP charges international students $16,774, more than twice the amount Wisconsin residents pay. The university has seen its international applicant volume decline from 57 to 45 in the past year. But the institution attaches more value to having an international student body than merely an addition to its budget. Quote, for our current students, having international students on our campus exposes them to a variety of different cultures and thinking and learning about other places in the world, Hill said. Loras College also saw international applicants decline in the past year from 55 to 45. Admissions Director Kyle Klapatoskas said the trend is not ringing alarms. He attributes it to the cancellation of college recruitment events during the pandemic and the hurdles that prospective students faced when trying to obtain visas. Quote, I do anticipate it is going to get better, Klapatoskas said. People are going to be traveling more. University of Dubuque declined to provide application figures for this article. A spokesperson stated that student enrollment data presents, quote, a clearer picture of our students versus college applications, end quote. Meanwhile, Dubuque area community colleges enroll virtually no international students. Turning to page 2 of today's Dubuque Telegraph Herald, we have news in brief. From Keeler, Wisconsin, comes news that authorities released details on crash that injured 3 near Dubuque Bridge. Authorities Monday released details on a 3-car wreck Friday on the Dubuque, Wisconsin Bridge that injured 3 people. Roy Turner III, aged 40, of Dubuque, was taken by ambulance to Mercy One Dubuque Medical Center with, quote, non-life-threatening, quote, injuries, while Max Hinderman Tilt, aged 24, of Hazel Green, and Marilyn Field, aged 73, of Potosi, were treated at the scene and released, according to the Grant County Sheriff's Department. The crash occurred at about 1:50 p.m. Friday on the Wisconsin portion of the US 61-151 on the bridge. A press release states that Turner was northbound in the right lane, driving at the speed below the 65-mile-per-hour limit when his vehicle was rear-ended by one driven by Hinderman Tilt. Turner's vehicle spun into the passing lane, while Hinderman Tilt's vehicle spun sideways and was struck by the vehicle being driven by Field. All 3 vehicles had to be towed from the scene. The crash remains under investigation. And according to authorities, rural Dubuque man is accused of cutting his ex-girlfriend with a steak knife during an assault Sunday. Devin M. Ward, age 26, was arrested at 6:11 p.m. Sunday in the 14,000 block of North Cascade Road on charges of domestic assault while using a weapon, domestic assault with strangulation, and child endangerment. Court documents state that Madeline J. Grant, aged 27, of 765 Kirkwood Street, had visited Ward's house to pick up some of her belongings when the pair argued. Grant told authorities that Ward, quote, grabbed her by the throat from behind and attempted to stab her with a steak knife, according to documents. Grant pushed Ward's arm away and Ward let go of her. Ward then placed Grant in a headlock. When Grant took her belongings to the front door, quote, Ward began stabbing at the garbage bags containing her belongings, and Grant sustained lacerations to her finger, according to documents. Ward's 2-year-old child was in the room during the alleged assault. Dubuque NAACP to host virtual community event about 1619 Project. The Dubuque branch of the NAACP will host a virtual community conversation on the 1619 Project. The event will be held at 7 p.m. Thursday, February 25th, via Zoom, according to an online announcement. This conversation will focus on the essay, quote, The Idea of America, end quote, and will be facilitated by Multicultural Family Center Director Jacqueline Hunter and Tara Verdia, Community Coordination Chairwoman of the local NAACP. The 1619 Project is a journalism project developed by the New York Times Magazine that, quote, aims to reframe the country's history by placing the consequences of slavery and the contributions of Black Americans at the very center of the United States' national narrative, end quote. Visit the website DubukeNAACP.com/1619Project for more information, including a link to the Zoom call. In the Dubuque Police and the Dubuque County Sheriff's Department's reports, Sasha E. Ginter, age 30, of 1709 White Street, No. 2, reported $1,981 worth of criminal damage done to a television and other items between 10 p.m. Saturday and 12:35 p.m. Sunday at her residence. Terry L. Morriston, age 42, of 718 Romberg Avenue, reported the theft of $1,508 worth of tools between 4:20 p.m. Saturday and 9:55 a.m. Sunday from 2133 Central Avenue. Bennett Goldstein reports parole denied again for man who murdered Grant County deputy. The chairman of the Wisconsin Parole Commission again has denied the parole request of a man who murdered a Grant County Sheriff's Department deputy. John Tate II has ordered that Gregory Coulthard, formerly of Cuba City, serve 3 more years in prison before being eligible for parole consideration again. Quote, the chair's decision in this case is based upon a review of Department of Corrections records, including your adjustment while incarcerated and the parole commissioner's findings and recommendation, Tate wrote in his decision. Coulthard received a life sentence in 1990 after a jury convicted him of first-degree intentional homicide for fatally shooting Deputy Thomas Reuter. Tate agreed with the assessment of Commissioner Douglas Drankowitz, who reviewed Coulthard's case in January and recommended a 5-year deferral. Drankowitz determined that Coulthard has not served sufficient time for punishment and presents an unreasonable risk to the public if released. But after renewing the initial ruling, Tate said that a 3-year deferral was, quote, appropriate, end quote, given, quote, the totality, end quote, of Coulthard's record. At his 1990 trial, Coulthard received a life sentence but became eligible for parole after 25 years. In 2015, the commission denied his release and deferred his next parole hearing until 2021. Both Tate and Drankowitz agree that Coulthard's institutional conduct and participation in programs within the correctional system have been satisfactory, and that the plan Coulthard had developed for his life after his release is satisfactory but needs approval from a parole agent. In an email, Coulthard called the decision, quote, good news, end quote. Quote, it is still higher than I would have wished for, but it is a positive step forward, he wrote. Coulthard seeks to return to Cuba City to live. A group of Cuba City volunteers have secured him employment and have pledged to oversee his transition into the community. Diane Reuter, who married Tom in 1973, declined to comment on the commission's decision. She previously described to the Telegraph Herald the pain Tom's murder caused her and their 5 children. Diane said she supported the family as a working mother without her dedicated partner to share in life's milestones. The night of the murder on March 18, 1990, Tom Reuter was nearing the end of his patrol when at about 11:30 p.m. he radioed in that he was stopping to check on a tractor on New California Road, 2 miles south of Livingston. He approached the implement, which was driven by the then 18-year-old Coulthard. Coulthard fired a shotgun, fatally hitting Reuter in the chest. Lloyd Rundy, who was the chief deputy of the Grant County Sheriff's Department at the time, agreed with the commission's recent decision on Coulthard's parole request. Quote, just the facts of the case don't warrant an early release, in my opinion, he said. Grant County Sheriff Nate Dreckman concurred. Quote, a law enforcement officer was just doing his job, just checking on a tractor on a side of road late at night, he said. To be shot and killed just for that? End quote. In today's local coronavirus-related news, each day the Telegraph Herald is recapping the changes in local COVID-19 testing and recovery. Monday's developments included 3 additional COVID-19-related deaths reported between 5 p.m. Sunday and 5 p.m. Monday in the tri-state area. 1 each was reported for Delaware, Dubuque, and Jackson counties. Dubuque County's toll of 192 deaths remains the 6th highest among Iowa counties, trailing only Polk with 542, Lynn with 309, Blackhawk with 285, Woodbury with 211, and Scott with 202. As of 5 p.m. Monday, Dubuque County had a 14-day positivity rate of 3.4%, while Clayton County was at 2.2%, Delaware County at 2%, Jackson County at 4.1%, and Jones County at 2.3%. Those rates fell markedly since the state on Friday implemented a change in which it uses total tests rather than the number of people tested in calculating those percentages. The state provided updated county-level hospitalization data on Monday. The figures as of Sunday afternoon showed that 9 Dubuque County residents with COVID-19 were hospitalized. Also hospitalized were 2 Jackson County residents, 2 from Jones County, and 1 from Clayton County. No such Delaware County residents were in the hospital at that time. As of 5 p.m. Monday, 1 local long-term care facility remained on the state's outbreak list. According to the state website, Stonehill Care Center in Dubuque has had 76 positive COVID-19 cases, 2 of which came in the past 14 days. Statewide, Iowa had 447 additional residents confirmed to have COVID-19 in the 24-hour period that ended at 5 p.m. Monday. That increased the to-date total to 333,087. A total of 3,374 related deaths also had been reported, an increase of 36 from 11 a.m. Sunday. As of 5 p.m. Monday statewide, 295,850 residents had received 1 dose of vaccine, while 146,603 were fully vaccinated. In Wisconsin, 423 additional cases were confirmed Monday, pushing the total to 599,998. There were no additional related deaths reported, so that toll remained at 6,284. Statewide, 455,190 residents had received one dose of vaccine as of Monday, while 352,791 were fully vaccinated. In Illinois, 1,246 additional COVID-19 cases were reported Monday, pushing the total to 1,175,655. There were 34 additional related deaths, so that toll moved to 20,303. Statewide, 1,069,180 residents had received one dose of vaccine as of Monday, while 571,260 were fully vaccinated. Turning to the opinion page in today's Dubuque Herald, Amy Gillian, Telegraph Herald executive editor, writes, "Letter from the editor. Remember to take care of one another." Senior reporter Eric Hogstrom looked back on Dubuque's crime statistics in 2020, and what it revealed was maybe not altogether surprising, but it certainly was troubling. If you didn't get a chance to read Eric's story on Sunday, it's worth circling back to. It's eye-opening. Dubuque Police Chief Mark Dalsing said it took a while for officers to see crime patterns emerging amid the pandemic. With fewer gatherings and limited activities at bars and restaurants, there was bound to be an impact on crime. Indeed, there was. COVID-19-related restrictions on movement and activities prompted a drop-off in certain crimes. When people are stuck inside, there tends to be less theft and other property crimes. But being stuck with the same people also can stir frustrations. Crimes against persons grew by 40.5% in Dubuque during 2020, while the incidence of other crimes remained relatively static or fell. Domestic violence calls were up 13%. Many people are dealing with challenges brought about by COVID: healthcare issues, unemployment, economic toll, isolation. For some people, all those pressures will become too much to bear. As we continue to weather this storm, reach out to those who might be in danger, and let's help take care of one another. The wrath of COVID-19 claims victims far beyond the virus itself. A life remembered. We have long done stories about the deaths of local individuals when they are people who are particularly accomplished, well-known, or interesting. One needs to read only the obituaries that run daily to see that we could easily write stories like that on any one of those folks. Everybody has a story, after all. Senior reporter Bennett Goldstein has been digging into these stories. Each week, Bennett will tell the story of a member of our local community who has died. They won't necessarily be the stories of business leaders, philanthropists, and elected officials who often draw the headlines. Instead, Bennett will focus on ordinary folks who lived ordinary lives, and he will remind us that in every life there is something extraordinary. Bennett has a great writer's touch for this kind of storytelling. I have enjoyed the pieces he's written thus far and hope you have too. Watch for A Life Remembered by Bennett Goldstein each week in the Telegraph Herald. You can almost smell the fish frying. Maybe you're like a lot of people who haven't been going out to restaurants. Good for you for staying safe. But cooking every meal every day, let's face it, that gets old. Hopefully, you've been supporting local restaurants by ordering takeout. Just in case you haven't, this month brings a taste you won't be able to resist. We present the All-American Fish Fry. Happy Lenten season, people. It's time to get our fish on. Sure, it won't be the same when you're not crammed into a church hall with half the town, but some fresh fried fish would hit the spot. Like last year, we've got a handy-dandy online map that will tell you where and when a bunch of area fish fries are happening. You can even add one if you know of one we missed. Check it out at the website telegraphherald.com/fish. And that was Amy Gilligan's letter from the editor for today. In letters to the editor, Stephanie Bauman on Prince Philip Drive in Dubuque writes, "TH endorsement unfair to Farber. I was very disappointed with the TH opinion piece regarding the City Council endorsement. I wholeheartedly support Susan Farber. I fully believe in her decision-making skills. I am confident that she will bring fresh eyes to the City Council, intelligence and passion, and that she would represent all of the people equally. I do not feel that the TH endorsement gave Susan Farber a fair shake. Signed, Stephanie Bauman from Prince Philip Drive in Dubuque. Today's opinion page also includes an Other View opinion written by John Hendrickson and Rusty Cannon. Hendrickson is Policy Director for Tax Education Foundation of Iowa, a public policy think tank. Cannon is Vice President of the Utah Taxpayers Association, a nonprofit group that advocates on behalf of tax policy. Their column today is titled, Iowa Must Strengthen Its Tax Transparency and Accountability Law. Iowa's high property taxes are a growing concern. The Tax Foundation examined the so-called effective tax rates on owner-occupied housing across the United States. Iowa ranked 12th highest in the nation. At the heart of high property taxes is local government spending. Unless spending is controlled, any property tax relief will be limited. Iowa's property tax system is complex and more transparency is needed. Iowa should look to Utah's Truth in Taxation Law, which since 1985 has been controlling the growth of property taxes and providing transparency and accountability for taxpayers. Utah's Truth in Taxation is the gold standard model for any property tax reform. During the 2019 Iowa legislative session, the legislature passed a property tax accountability and transparency law. This new law requires local governments, such as counties and cities, school districts were not included, to hold a public hearing if the proposed budget increases more than 2% above the previous year, and a supermajority vote for the increase to be enacted. This new 2% so-called soft cap is meant to control the growth of property taxes and requires local governments to provide more transparency within the local budget process. The 2019 law is often referred to as a so-called truth in taxation measure, and even though the measure did increase transparency and accountability, it should not be compared to Utah's law. Utah's truth in taxation law is considered one of the most taxpayer-friendly property tax laws in the nation. The truth in taxation law is a revenue-based limitation, which means as valuations increase, property tax rates decrease. Utah's truth in taxation law guarantees that each taxing entity receives the same property tax revenues as the previous year, including new growth. This prevents local governments from getting a windfall because valuations have increased. Truth in taxation works to prevent local governments from benefiting from increased assessments. If assessments increase by 10%, it does not mean that local government budgets should increase by 10%. If a local government wants to exceed the certified tax rate, it then requires a truth in taxation hearing that is accompanied by an extensive public notification and hearing process. Truth in taxation also forces local government officials to take recorded votes to approve an increase in tax collections. Through the truth in taxation process, local governments must justify why they want to increase taxes for additional spending, forcing them to be more transparent as to why they need additional tax revenue. A crucial aspect of Utah's law is a direct notification requirement where notices are sent to taxpayers providing information on the proposed tax increase. It also includes the date, time, location of the Truth in Taxation budget hearing. This extensive public notification and hearing process has been successful, and taxpayers in Utah actively participate in Truth in Taxation hearings. Iowa could implement a similar direct notification system either by email or mail, or both, to let property taxpayers know of a potential tax increase. Iowa property taxpayers deserve greater transparency in understanding their total property tax bill. This will help prevent local governments from hiding windfalls from increased assessments and provide greater clarity for the taxpayer. The objective of property tax reform should not be to single out certain classes of property, but rather ensure all Iowans receive tax relief. In addition, property tax relief should not favor one class of taxpayer over another. For example, it is often argued that senior citizens on fixed incomes should have targeted property tax relief, but the danger in applying this targeted relief is that it shifts the tax burden to other taxpayers. The fixed income argument also becomes relative because the senior citizen may be on a fixed income, but so is the family with both parents working and trying to provide for their family. If the goal is to ensure all Iowans receive property tax relief, then the best approach is to strengthen the 2019 Property Tax Transparency and Accountability Measure by requiring a Utah-style truth in taxation process. Again, this is the opinion of John Hendrickson and Rusty Cannon. You are listening to the reading of the Dubuque Telegraph Herald for Tuesday, February 23, 2021, on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and Print Disabled. Now let's turn to today's obituaries. Christine Elizabeth Noonan, known as Chris, aged 71, of Dubuque, passed away Saturday, February 20th at home. Visitation will be from 4 p.m. to 7 p.m. Tuesday, February 23rd, at Egelhoff Siegert and Casper Funeral Home and Crematory, 2659 John F. Kennedy Road in Dubuque. In honor of her grandson Jack, the family would enjoy seeing their guests wear something purple. Mass of Christian burial will be at 10:30 a.m. Wednesday, February 24th, at St. Anthony Catholic Church, and will be live-streamed on the church website at www.stanthony-dubuque.org. Reverend Stephen Rosanke will officiate. Masks are required at both the church and the funeral home. Chris was born May 27, 1949, in Dubuque, the daughter of Clarence Lefty and Margaret Mimi Donahue Coob. She married James Jim Noonan in Dubuque on May 3, 1969. Chris enjoyed word puzzles, watching Harry Potter and NCIS, and visiting the salon to get her hair and nails done. She was a devoted grandmother and loved watching her grandkids and attending their sporting events. Chris is survived by her husband Jim of Dubuque, one son, Sean and Shanda Noonan of Ankeny, two daughters, Molly and Billy Bodish and Aaron and Russ Tompkins, both of Dubuque, and her grandchildren, Connor Noonan, Cody and Hope Krause, and Ella, Tanner, and Aubrey Tompkins. She was preceded in death by her grandson, Jack Noonan, her parents, Lefty and Mimi Coob, and her in-laws, Frank and Elaine Noonan, and two sisters. Memorials may be made to Hospice of Dubuque. Barbara Lita Elliott, aged 76, passed away at home early in the morning of Friday, February 19th, in the comforting care of her family. A private service has been held for family. Barb was born on February 26, 1944, at Findlay Hospital, the daughter of Lewis and Alma Elliott. She graduated from Dubuque Senior High School and retired from Barnstead Thermaline. She enjoyed horses, puzzles, and books. Those honoring Barb's memory are her sister, Audrea Elliott, brother, Louis Elliott, daughters, Deborah and Danette Abresh, sons, Daniel Jr. and Jessica, and David and Christy Abresh, 10 grandchildren and 5 great-grandchildren. In addition to her parents, Barb was preceded in death by her brother, William. Gregory P. Staskell, aged 74, of Cuba City, Wisconsin, passed away on Saturday, February 20, 2021. Funeral services will be held at 11 a.m. on Thursday, February 25th, at the United Methodist Church in Cuba City, Wisconsin. Burial will be in the Mount Pleasant Cemetery in Cuba City, Wisconsin. Friends and family may call from 4 to 7 p.m. on Wednesday, February 24th, at the Howden Shield Funeral Home and Cremation Services in Cuba City. Also on Thursday, February 25th, from 9:30 a.m. until the time of service at the United Methodist Church in Cuba City. Complete arrangements are pending at the Howden Shield Funeral Home and Cremation Services in Cuba City. Damian Grub, age 34, of Stockton, Illinois, died Monday, February 15th. Visitation will be held from 9 a.m. to 11 a.m. Saturday, February 27th, at Herman Funeral Home in Stockton, where a memorial service will take place at 11 a.m. And in funeral service announcements, services for Mary J. Brooke of Dubuque, visitation will be 10:30 a.m. Friday, February 26th at Mount Carmel Mother House Chapel. Mass of Christian burial will be 10:45 a.m. Friday at the chapel. Services for Roger A. Ewers, Jr. of Platteville, visitation from 10 to 11:45 a.m. Thursday, February 25th. At Melby Funeral Home and Crematory in Platteville. Services noon Thursday at the funeral home. Barbara A. Waller Gottenbein of Dubuque. Visitation 9 to 11 a.m. today, Tuesday, February 23rd, at Leonard Funeral Home and Crematory in Dubuque. Services at 11 a.m. today at the funeral home. Verna M. Greenwood of Farley. Mass of Christian burial at 10:30 a.m. today at St. Joseph's Catholic Church in Farley. Robert E. Henning of Cascade. Celebration of life 4 to 6 p.m. Thursday, February 25th at Community Presbyterian Church in Cascade. Susan B. Hunergarth of Bellevue. Visitation, 9 to 11:30 a.m. Saturday, February 27th, at St. John's Lutheran Church in Bellevue. Services at noon Saturday at the church. That concludes today's obituaries and funeral service notices. Turning to sports, prep bowling is the focus of the first page of the sports section. An article by Jim Leitner is titled, Bobcats Set School Standard. Lainey Conzen and Sarah Horsfield wanted to end their high school bowling careers on a high note. Mission accomplished. The seniors finished 9th and 10th individually and helped Western Dubuque shoot a school record 3,016 to finish 3rd in the team competition Monday afternoon in the Iowa Class 2A State Tournament at Cadillac Lanes in Waterloo, Iowa. Quote, it feels awesome for Sarah and I to be able to go out with a bang, bringing home some hardware and setting the school record, said Conzen, who will bowl at Hawkeye Community College in the fall. Quote, it's a great ending to our high school careers. I can only thank my teammates and coaches for always hyping me up and putting a smile on my face whenever I threw a bad ball. I stayed relaxed, and my teammates had a lot to do with that. You can't win a state team championship by yourself. You have to be involved with everyone and make sure everyone else is bowling at their best, and you do that by picking each other up. And we did a great job of that today. End quote. Conzen rolled a 232-202, 434, and Horsfield shot a 232-191, 423, to reach the individual awards ceremony reserved for the top 10 finishers. Waterloo East's Stephanie Burge bagged a 267-214, 481, to defeat Keokuk's Jasmine Saunders by 10 pins for the individual title. Horsfield's performance came on the heels of winning the regional title last week. She led the Bobcats with a 193.5 average entering the state tournament. Quote, this is definitely how I would have wanted to end my bowling career, said Horsfield, who doesn't plan to bowl in college. It's hard to beat setting the school record and bringing a trophy back to Western Dubuque. End quote. Lamar's shot a whopping 3,061 to win the state championship by 27 pins over Keokuk after those two schools earned the top two seeds at regionals last week. Western Dubuque, the number three seed, beat fourth-seeded Waterloo East by 27 pins a week after holding on to edge the Trojans by 25 pins to win the regional, also held at Cadillac. Western Dubuque sophomore Kirsten Butcher finished 17th at state with a 213-183-396, just 10 pins ahead of junior teammate Cece Daly's 18th-place effort. Freshman Bailey Nyan claimed 23rd with a 183-179-362, and the Bobcats didn't count junior Sam Nuss's 176-142-318 that took 37ths. The Bobcats shot 2,001 in individuals to join Lamar's at 2,029, Waterloo East at 2,021, and Keokuk at 1,989 in a four-way shootout entering the Baker portion of the 18 tournament. Western Dubuque opened with a 152, but rebounded for games of 202, 257, 194, and 210 to storm back into contention and break the school record by 10 pins. Keokuk led the way in the Baker series with 1,045, followed by Lamar's at 1,037, Western Dubuque at 1,015, and Waterloo East at 886. Quote, we've always been kind of slow starters in Baker's, first-year Western Dubuque coach Larry Knipper said. We always have our troubles in that first game, and then we pick it up. It was just a matter of them trying to relax and not get in too big of a hurry. We knew Lamar's and Keokuk were going to be tough because they've averaged around 2,900 all season. So we just told the girls, let's go over there and have fun. Don't get too wrapped up in winning it. Have fun and see what happens from there. End quote. The girls were joking around and stayed pretty calm for most of the day. End quote. In boys basketball news, in the Iowa Class 4A sub-state quarterfinal, Dubuque Senior over Davenport West. This is a story by Steve Ortman with the title, Rams Finding Peak. Dubuque Senior always had the long term in mind. With a roster building chemistry as the year went along and waiting for the moment, spark plug, Kendrick Watkins-Hogue would be cleared to return from an eligibility issue, the Rams stumbled to a 2-7 start to the season. But through those early trials and tribulations, the players didn't lose sight of the end goal. Quote, "We knew how good we could be at the beginning of the season," senior guard Kane McWilliams said. "We just felt like we got off to a rough start and that we weren't playing our best. Once we figured things out and worked at it during practice, we knew it would come together and we could get wins when it mattered," end quote. Peaking at the perfect time, the Rams won their 7th straight game on Monday night and earned themselves another crack at their city rivals for round 3. McWilliams scored a game-high 21 points, Jim Boniface added 19, and Max Link had 13 as the Rams pulled away for a 69-58 victory over Davenport West in an Iowa Class 4A Sub-State 5 quarterfinal at Nora Gymnasium. Senior, with a record of 10-8, advanced to Friday's Sub-State semifinal at number 5-ranked Dubuque Hempstead with a record of 15-4, which swept the Rams during the regular season. Quote, "We knew we had the guys that could make a run in late February and early March," Boniface said. "We just had to get some guys in the groove and really play together. After a while, we found our rhythm and we're going now. We've been wanting that one with Hempstead. We've got the opportunity and now it's time to do our thing," end quote. The Falcons, with a record of 7-8, never let Senior get totally comfortable and even took an early 9-4 lead. Link sank a jumper and a three-pointer to give Senior the lead, but West answered for a 13-12 lead at the end of a first period that saw 8 lead changes. Senior went on a 22-12 run over the course of the second quarter to take control. Link hit a deep triple, then Boniface snagged a steal and made a pretty deep pass to Watkins Hogue, who finished with a two-handed jam. McWilliams hit back-to-back trays, and then Link added another as the Rams built a 34-25 lead at the break. Quote, "We've got 7 in a row going," senior coach Wendell Imers said. "We knew we were underachieving. We knew it was going to click at some point. We've been playing pretty well. We had some good minutes and bad minutes tonight, but I'm just glad to get that first tournament game out of the way," end quote. The Falcons made things interesting in a wild third quarter that saw 41 combined points scored. A quick 7-0 run to open the frame by West cut Senior's lead to 34-32, but the Rams responded with a 6-0 run capped by McWilliams' steal and layup. Quote, "We just had to make sure we kept our composure," McWilliams said. "They started the third with a 7-0 run, and we've gone through that type of stuff before. We just have to keep playing and come back strong," end quote. Senior's resident big man, Boniface, carried the Rams when the Falcons tightened up and played more physical inside. The Iowa State football recruit scored 11 points in the third and fired up the student section with a giant roar after a hard-fought basket and the foul to extend the lead to 47-41. Quote, "That's the way I love to play, being a football guy," Boniface said. "If that's the way the game's going and we're not picking up fouls down there, I love playing that way. That didn't bother me. I really enjoyed that," end quote. McWilliams and Sam Akins then chipped in a pair of triples before Tyler Schuster scored in the final seconds for a 55-45 lead heading to the fourth. Quote, "The third quarter was a roller coaster," Imer said. "We had to get some reversals and got some good shots. Jim Boniface was really tough inside, and we shot the ball well. The guards had open threes, and they knocked them down," end quote. Now comes the final and most important round with Hempstead, which swept the first two games of the season from the Rams, 69-42 at Moody Gym on January 5th and 63-53 at Nora Gym on January 29th. Quote, "We're definitely looking for some revenge against them," McWilliams said. "We know it's going to be a battle. We'll be ready," end quote. Meanwhile, Danny Miller reports on the Class 3A Sub-State quarterfinal in which Western Dubuque topped Benton Community 80-48. It's hardly a secret by now, but Western Dubuque has some firepower. The Class 3A number 7-ranked Bobcats were razor-sharp in all facets of their game as they handled Benton Community 80-48 in their 3A Sub-State opener Monday night. Dylan Johnson had a game-high 25 points, including 3 thunderous dunks, and Garrett Baumhover, who assisted on 2 of the Rim Rockers, added 19 points of his own. Quote, "We were able to have a lot more of a crowd here tonight, so that just brought the energy," Johnson said of his slam dunks. Western Dubuque, at 16-4, wasted no time jumping ahead early as it used an 8-0 run to open the game. Baumhover connected on 2 of his 3 trays in the opening minutes to catapult the run. After 2 consecutive steals and layups by Baumhover and Carson Schutte, the Bobcats were ahead, 17-2. Another 8-0 run early in the second quarter extended the lead even farther. Baumhofer's pinpoint alley-oop feed from wing to Johnson for a slam sent to the WD faithful into an uproar and gave them a 28-8 advantage at 5:01. Later in the quarter, Johnson proved he could throw down on his own as he stripped the ball and took it the other way for a one-handed dunk to ignite the crowd even more. Western Dubuque forced 11 first-half turnovers to take a 38-23 halftime lead. Quote, "Overall, I thought we did a pretty good job tonight," WD coach Wayne Cusick said. "I thought we played like we focused, lost it a little bit before halftime, but then we talked about doing it and stayed focused on doing what we have to do in the third quarter." Benton got within 12 early in the third when Blake Darty connected on one of his 5 3-pointers, but Western Dubuque quickly had an answer. Baumhofer and Johnson paired up again for another highlight in the midst of a 13-0 run that put the game away for good. After a steal, Baumhofer was headed for a wide-open layup when he perfectly bounced it off the backboard to a trailing Johnson for another crowd-rocking hammer and a 51-30 advantage. Western Dubuque advanced to host Waverly Shellrock, which defeated Dubuque Wallert 61-54 in its quarterfinal in the next round. Johnson said if his team follows a similar formula, they will be ready come Thursday. Quote, "We just played good as a team and we were communicating out there. I think that helped us," he said. "We just need to come in to practice tomorrow and the next couple of days and build on it." End quote. In today's installment of the Love That Lasts series, Annie Mail of the Telegraph Herald writes, "Couple says togetherness, key to 66 years of marriage." Gene and Michael Knepper of Dyersville regularly play cards deep into the night. Every evening and into the late hours of the night, Gene and Michael Knepper sit together at their dining room table playing rummy. Prior to the COVID-19 pandemic, they were constantly on the go. They attended card clubs and bowling league and golfed. Now they sit at home every day and rely on each other for companionship. But as long as they're together, it's more than enough. Quote, "It's just a testimony to their love for each other," said their daughter, Julie Oberding. "They are competitive and they are so good. Dad is so analytical about the game and Mom is just lucky," end quote. Gene, aged 89, and Michael, aged 91, celebrated their 66th wedding anniversary on February 12th. They met at a dance in Worthington, Iowa, when Gene was about 20 years old. "When her eyes found Michael in the room, she thought he was good-looking," she said. They spent the evening dancing together, and later he drove her home. While they were dating, Michael was drafted into the U.S. Army and was sent overseas to South Korea. When he returned 2 years later, they married and moved to the farm in Cascade where he was raised. They had 7 children, Julie Oberding, Lynn Clapsaddle, Dean Knepper, Mark Knepper, Alan Knepper, Sue Menke, and Sarah Knepper, who died in infancy. Oberding remembers life on the farm being busy for both of her parents, but she isn't sure who was ever busier. They both seem to have their hands full constantly. Quote, "I don't ever remember them discussing who does what," Oberding said. "They both knew their responsibilities. They divided and conquered somehow. They worked very, very hard on the farm, but Sunday was play day," end quote. A memorable Sunday trip was the time her parents took the whole family up to Madison, Wisconsin, to spend the day at the zoo, Oberding said. That day also stands out to Michael, who said that in order to leave on time, he got up at about 3 a.m. to finish his chores. Quote, "I did the chores, and we left at like 7 a.m., and the kids had a lot of fun," he recalled. "On the way back, I saw the sign for the house on the rock. It struck me kind of funny, so we went," end quote. Even though Michael knew it would turn his and Jean's long day into an even longer one, it was worth it to have fun with their family, he said. Michael and Jean farmed together in Cascade for 40 years before moving to Dyersville, where they currently reside. While he took care of the outdoor chores at the farm, she cooked, cleaned, and cared for their kids. Jean also was the gardener and mowed the lawn. Quote, "We had a big yard, so I took care of that, and I had a garden," she said. "It was a full day's work," end quote. Oberding said she admires her parents' sense of adventure. She said they took their whole family on a cruise to Alaska to celebrate their 60th anniversary. Quote, "They are both energetic, hardworking, and get after whatever lies ahead of them," she said. "They are so sharp, and we truly feel lucky to have them role modeling such a positive attitude on life," end quote. When asked what having a successful marriage means to them, Michael's answer was simple. Quote, "As a man, you just say yes," he said, laughing. Gene said, "You just learn to work things out." Even before the pandemic, they knew they could rely on each other for anything. Quote, "We just worked things out together," she said. You can have problems, but you can work them out. Just don't quit. End quote. Returning to local news, John Cruz of the Telegraph Herald reports, local lawmaker proposes repeal of gun ownership cards. A local Illinois lawmaker seeks to repeal a state-required identification card for residents to buy and own guns. State Representative Andrew Chesney, a Republican from Freeport, filed a bill this month that would eliminate firearms owners' identification card requirements. Illinois residents who want to purchase or possess guns or ammunition in the state must apply and be approved to receive a card. To be eligible, applicants must not have been convicted of a felony, not have been a patient in a mental health facility in the past 5 years, and not have been diagnosed with intellectual disability, among other requirements. Chesney said the program has become outdated and an unnecessary burden on gun owners. Quote, it's a broken and antiquated system, he said. It doesn't help anything, and it's only making life harder for gun owners in the state. End quote. Chesney said the application process largely duplicates federal background checks, which are required for gun purchases nationwide and take a relatively short time to complete. In contrast, Illinois State Police faces a backlog of FOID card applications, creating delays for firearm owners looking to apply for or renew their cards. According to Illinois State Police, the average processing time for an FOID application as of January 2021 is 121 days. Quote, you have situations where people are waiting for months and unable to do anything, Chesney said. John Onskorg of East Dubuque said he and other local gun owners are often hindered by what he called a convoluted application process for an FOID card. Quote, Illinois State Police can't keep up with the demand, especially during COVID, he said. A lot of people are waiting for up to a year and they can't do anything until it arrives, end quote. William Hollenbeck, owner of Three Nails Gunsmithing in East Dubuque, said he believes the cards are necessary and help preliminarily identify people eligible to purchase firearms. Quote, I like having a system where I know that I can legally deal with this person, he said. However, he thinks the system is currently poorly implemented and that reforms are needed to expedite the application process. Quote, the system is so flawed that it isn't even funny, Hollenbeck said. That doesn't mean you get rid of it entirely, but it does need to be revamped. End quote. Sanvi Ram for the Telegraph Herald reports, local librarians honor Library Lovers Month. February typically is known for being the month of Valentine's, with candy hearts and boxes filled to the brim with chocolates. However, for some, the month marks something else, a love for libraries. I remember my mom taking me to a library for the first time. I saw rows and rows of books stacked upon each other. It was mind-blowing for me to comprehend that I could read any book that was there. Since then, going to the library has become a part of my monthly routine. According to the Pew Research Center, about 8 in 10 adults believe that public libraries help them find trustworthy and reliable information. Approximately the same amount also said that libraries help them learn new things from the resources they provide. Local libraries also have become home to book clubs, art shows, internet access, and staff always ready to help patrons. What's not to love? In the spirit of Library Lovers Month, and due to so many picking up a book or two throughout their time spent at home amid COVID-19, I decided to interview a handful of local librarians to see what they had to say about their favorite book. Jenna Diedrich of Galena, Public Library Director, says, my favorite novel is Pachinko by Min Jin Lee. This story is about a sweeping epic following 4 generations of a Korean family living through Japanese colonization and warfare. Ann Williams, Eleanor Roosevelt Middle School librarian, says, I love The Book Thief by Marcus Zusak. The author's use of words amazed me. Death narrates the story of Liesl, a young orphan girl who goes to live with foster parents. Her foster father teaches her to read, and she falls in love with books. Her situation becomes more dangerous after she saves a book from a Nazi bonfire, and later, her foster family hides a young Jewish boy in their cellar. It's a beautiful and moving story set in Germany during World War II. Jessie Lee Jones, the Platteville Public Librarian, says, I really liked This Tender Land, a novel by William Ken Kruger. This Tender Land is the story of 4 orphaned children that escape from an American Indian boarding school during the Great Depression. The kids canoe down the Mississippi River in search of a new home and meet some interesting characters along the way. And that does it for today's reading of the Dubuque Telegraph Herald for Tuesday, February 23rd, 2021. I'm your reader, Paula Carrezzi. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org. Thank you for listening.